Every composer since J.S. Bach thinks that he is Bach. Some copy him directly, and some are just inspired by his genius and try to match it. Today, as we close out our Epic Bach Week, let's take a few minutes to celebrate those composers who were inspired by Bach and his talents. I'm your host, Robbie Rainey, and this is the Epic Bach Week on the 3 B's. And today, our title is Bach, the Inspiration. Good morning to you, and welcome to the 3 B's. We've come to the end of our Epic Bach Week here on WSMC. In the studio with me this morning is Dr. Peter Cooper, one of the music professors here at Southern Adventist University. He teaches music theory, ear training, and piano lessons. Dr. Cooper, it's so wonderful to have you with us here this morning.
Thank you, Robbie. It's a real pleasure to be here and a privilege to talk with you and your listeners today about Bach.
And specifically today, we're going to talk about Bach, the Inspiration. What have you found in your research for this topic that could support that Bach was indeed an inspiration?
I think what I'd like to have us listen to today and explore are two basic ways that Bach influenced and inspired composers of later generations. The first is through looking at specific stylistic traits from the Baroque period. And even though a number of Baroque composers wrote music that utilized these stylistic traits, which you'd expect from Baroque composers, for composers of later generations, often their portal into the Baroque period was the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. And so we'll be looking at repertoire from later composers using some of the same stylistic traits that Bach used in his music. And then the second group of works that we'll look at are works by composers who actually took music from Bach himself, Bach's own music, and incorporated it into their works.
And you have a few quotes for us first before we get started, right?
Yes, I thought it would be interesting to see what some of the later musicians actually wrote or said about Bach, what composers wrote, what performers said about Bach. I'd like to start with a quote from the great Spanish cellist and composer and conductor Pablo Casals, and this is what Casals wrote in his book, Joys and Sorrows. For the past 80 years, I have started each day in the same manner. It is not a mechanical routine, but something essential to my daily life. I go to the piano, and I play 2 preludes and fugues of Bach. I cannot think of doing otherwise. It is a sort of benediction on the house. That is Bach, like nature, a miracle.
And Robert Schumann was a great influence on another one of our B's, Johannes Brahms, and he wrote something not just about Bach's music, but about Bach as an individual.
Yes, Schumann wrote, "How great and rich was the contrast between his inner being and his exterior. It was not only industry that allowed him to triumph over all the difficulties of musical combination, but an innate acumen. When we, who come after him, think we have discovered some marvelous configuration of tones, we find he has already used it or even developed it further. Besides this consummate mastery of the craft, his work has ideas and spirit. He was a real man. He did nothing by halves. His work is always complete, written for eternity."
And Schumann also thought that Bach was essential for his students.
Schumann and Chopin both, of course, we know that Chopin made a significant amount of the money he lived on as a teacher. Schumann said about the Well-Tempered Clavier, the collection of Bach's preludes and fugues, examples of which we'll hear a little bit later in the program. Schumann said, "Play conscientiously the fugues of good masters, above all, those of Johann Sebastian Bach." And he continued, "Let the Well-Tempered Clavier be your daily bread. Then you will certainly become a solid musician." And Chopin, when he was teaching, considered these preludes and fugues to be indispensable to the pianist.
Schumann was talking about Bach being the daily bread. How do you think Bach would have felt about that description of himself? Would he have been comfortable with it?
I think he would have understood it for what it was, but I think he would have resonated with the idea of day by day, consistently, kind of slow and steady wins the race, keep working at your task, at your craft. Bach himself said this, and it's a remarkable quote. He said, "I have had to work hard. Anyone who works just as hard will get just as far."
We know that Johannes Brahms' mother died quite early on in his life, and we have music like the Horn Trio and German Requiem that came from about that same time. But it also turns out that there's a connection between the death of Brahms' mother and Johann Sebastian Bach.
Here's an anecdote I found in Malcolm McDonald's biography of Bach, and I thought it was very poignant. Brahms had returned to Vienna in 1865 after the death of his mother. And Brahms at the time received an unannounced visit from the cellist Josef Gansbacher. And Gansbacher writes, he said he found Brahms practicing Bach keyboard music. Brahms told him of his loss with tears streaming down his cheeks, but he never stopped his playing. And so here is Brahms grieving his mother's death through the playing of Bach keyboard music.
Any musician of the past decades, when thinking about Bach's keyboard music, would think of the great Bach interpreter Glenn Gould. What did Gould have to say about Bach's eternal music?
Well, Gould is such an interesting individual, in my opinion. Not only was he, I think, a fabulous keyboardist at any keyboard instrument he put his hands to, but he was also a deep thinker, a composer. He was a recording producer. He was really a Renaissance man in so many ways. And he has spoken and written significantly on Bach. But I found a quote that he wrote in Gramophone magazine that I thought was, it's one of those questions that music students ask all the time. If you were stranded on a desert island, whose music would you have there? Whose music would you want to listen to stranded on this desert island? Glenn Gould wrote this in Gramophone. "I think that if I were required to spend the rest of my life on a desert island and to listen to or play the music of any one composer during all that time, that composer would almost certainly be Bach. I really can't think of any other music which is so all-encompassing, which moves me so deeply and so consistently, and which, to use a rather imprecise word, is valuable beyond all of its skill and brilliance for something more meaningful than that, its humanity."
You mentioned one of my all-time favorite quotes regarding Bach. It's by Beethoven, another one of our three B's. Why would Beethoven say this? Why don't you tell us the quote and then tell us what you think it means?
Well, your listeners will know that in German the word Bach means brook.
Like a little stream.
Like a little stream, that's correct. And so Beethoven's quote, this well-known quote, is, "His name, that is Bach, ought not to be Bach or little brook, but ocean, because of his infinite and inexhaustible wealth of combinations and harmonies." For me, this is such a meaningful quote because I think in many ways it sums up this inspiration and influence that Bach had on later composers. Composers saw in Bach's music an inexhaustible wealth of creativity and craft. Not only the aesthetics and the beauty and the expression, but also the working out of those musical ideas and concepts in a way that had integrity. There's something that composers, when they talk about coming in contact with Sebastian Bach, there's almost something, if not cathartic, there's a sense of getting back to basics, of cleaning up their act, so to speak, of tidying things up, of working within that incredible craft and discipline that we find in Bach's music throughout his entire compositional output.
Before the program started, we were talking a little bit and we compared Bach's music to the baseball playing of Hank Aaron. Not every time Bach wrote a piece and not every time that Hank Aaron went up to bat did he hit a home run, but he's certainly got the law of averages on his side.
Well, I think Henry Aaron had such an integrity as a baseball player, both defensively but certainly offensively with all the home runs that he hit. It's in the nature of home run hitters that they take risks. They swing big for the fence. When we were talking earlier, I think my point was that for Bach, there is such an integrity to everything he does. One may not aesthetically enjoy everything that he writes. I think, for example, of the six keyboard partitas, and all the dance movements are there. They're wonderful movements, but I think some are more aesthetically pleasing than others. So one maybe could say Bach didn't hit a home run every time, but the integrity with which he applied himself to his work is beyond question. And frankly, I think he hit more home runs than maybe anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've heard several quotes about Bach's influence on the personal lives and the studies of many different composers and musicians, but it's probably time now that we should turn to some music. You mentioned at the very beginning of the program that part of why composers look back to Bach is that he's the pinnacle of understanding Baroque figurations and rhythms and things like that. What music supports that in your mind?
Well, I thought we'd start by looking at some of the figuration that we find in Bach. And one of the most basic of these is to take a chord, a three-note, four-note chord, and to play the notes not necessarily blocked together, but to break them in what we call an arpeggio. And so the first example I thought we'd listen to is an example from Bach's set of Preludes and Fugues, The Well-Tempered Clavier, the first book. And I thought it's a good place to start at the beginning, so we'll start with the C major prelude from Book One of The Well-Tempered Clavier. And listen to how Bach basically writes a series of chords, but a series of chords that are broken, that are arpeggiated.
Heard that wonderful music there of Johann Sebastian Bach from the first book of The Well-Tempered Clavier. It's beautiful music, but Dr. Cooper, how does this relate to other later composers? What have they done with something similar to that?
There are a number of keyboard composers who wrote sets of preludes in all the major and minor keys, which I think, as you've already discussed with your listeners in an earlier show, The Well-Tempered Clavier is a collection of preludes and fugues in all the major and minor keys. Chopin wrote a set of piano preludes. The first one is in C major, and we'll listen to that in just a second, and you'll hear, just like in the Bach, it's essentially a series of broken chords, arpeggiated chords, but in Chopin's style, as opposed to a Bachian style. And then the Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich wrote a set of preludes and fugues, 24, one in each of the major and minor keys. I thought we would listen to the C major prelude from Shostakovich's set. Interestingly enough, Shostakovich uses chords, but they're not broken chords. They're blocked chords. The notes are all played together, and he writes using the old dance, the saraband, which we find over and over in Bach's dance suites. So let's listen first to the Chopin C major prelude from Opus 28, and then the Shostakovich C major prelude from Opus 87.
We heard music there just a moment ago by Dmitri Shostakovich, the first prelude from his Opus 87 set. It was in C major. And before that, we heard music of Frédéric Chopin, also a C major prelude, the first of his Opus 28 set of preludes. And we were looking at what those composers did with their chord writing, either arpeggiating them or playing them more blocked, sort of comparing them to Bach's well-tempered clavier. Dr. Peter Cooper is in the studio with me this morning. We're talking about Bach the artist. Dr. Cooper, what else did Bach do with his notes that other composers later on sort of copied?
Well, another basic element of music is rhythm. And in the Baroque period, of course, we find many varied rhythms, but perhaps two broad types of rhythms we can talk about would be, one, what musicologists call a motor rhythm, a consistent use of, for example, 16th notes or maybe some 8th notes thrown in, but a rhythm that gives the idea of being a heartbeat, a pulse, which is why the term motor rhythm comes into play. And so I thought we'd listen to a couple of examples of music, one by Bach and one again from the Shostakovich set. The Bach example that we'll hear first is the prelude in D major from the second book of the Well-Tempered Clavier. And you'll hear an example of this motor rhythm throughout this excerpt. And Shostakovich, in his A major prelude from Opus 87, the number 7, writes music whose rhythm I think reminds one of Bach. So in addition to motor rhythm, a second approach to rhythm that we hear in the Baroque is the use of the dotted rhythms, not the even rhythms of the motor rhythm, but the dotted rhythms, the longs and shorts, sometimes really long with a quick short note, as evidenced, for example, in the Baroque period in the French overture. So again, we have two examples, one from J.S. Bach, one from Shostakovich, with their use of dotted rhythms. The Bach is the prelude in G minor from the second book of the Well-Tempered Clavier, and the Shostakovich is the B minor prelude, Opus 87, number 6. Thank you.
We heard a couple of pieces that demonstrate the wonderful dotted rhythms that were very prevalent in the Baroque era, especially in the French-style overtures. The first example that we heard was from the prelude in G minor from the second book of the Well-Tempered Clavier by Bach, and the second example was the prelude in B minor number 6 from Dmitri Shostakovich's Opus 87. You are listening to the 3Bs on WSMC. Let's turn now to some of the compositional techniques that Bach maybe didn't invent, but he took to new levels, and that other composers have looked at and learned from, and gone on to write their own music using that technique. One technique that comes immediately to mind is the fugue, which we've talked about a couple of times already this week, but I'll recap just a little bit. A fugue is based on one subject, which is basically the fugue tune going through in one voice. Say the sopranos are singing it. Then it will come in another voice, in the altos, and the alto part is just as important as the soprano part. And then when it comes in the tenor part is just as important as the other two parts, and the same with the bass. Each moving part is just as important as the next part in the fugue. Dr. Cooper, what examples do you have for us from the repertoire that shows how Bach wrote the fugues and other composers learned from them and imitated them?
I have three examples of fugues for us to listen to this morning. One by J.S. Bach, one by the German Romantic composer Felix Mendelssohn, and of course one by Shostakovich. In each case, I'd like your listeners to note how the subject or the basic building block of the composition is presented at the beginning. And in each case, what the composers seek to do is write music that is all based on that basic building block. One of the things that I think Bach, one of the ways in which Bach inspired and influenced later composers was through his ability to take a very simple idea and from that simple idea generate an entire composition. So the fugue that I've chosen for us to listen to from Bach is from the Well-Tempered Clavier, Book 1. It's the delightful E-flat major. Mendelssohn has a set of preludes and fugues, Opus 35. I've chosen the F minor fugue, which is number 5 of that set. And I think your listeners will listen to this and think they're listening, frankly, to Bach. It's only in the treatment of the harmonies that one, I think, gets the idea that it's more Mendelssohn than it is Bach. And then the Shostakovich fugue is the A-flat major fugue from Opus 87, number 17, a delightful and cheerful piece.
Thank you.
we heard several different fugues that all are based on a single building block, if you will, called the subject. And Dr. Cooper, you have some music for us now that's based on another type of building block. This, instead of a theme, a little melody, this is based on a chord progression. And the something that's based off of a short chord progression that's repeated over and over is called a chaconne. And you have several different examples of that for us, right?
I do. And examples from various types of repertoire. Again, starting with Bach, we'll hear an excerpt from the chaconne from the D minor solo violin partita. I'd like, though, then to go to an orchestral piece. We've not heard any orchestral music. This is the magnificent, an excerpt from the magnificent fourth movement of the Brahms Fourth Symphony. And it's no accident that Brahms would immerse himself in the techniques and structures and forms from the Baroque period. And so we find this last movement. Brahms calls it, or it's referred often to as a passacaglia, but it's basically a harmonic progression that goes throughout the entire symphony. We'll hear a short excerpt from the beginning of that movement. And then the third example I have is a remarkable movement from the Shostakovich Second Piano Trio, the E minor piano trio. It's the slow movement, the largo, which again is built on a harmonic progression and helps Shostakovich express the deep, deep sorrow he felt at the death of his good friend, the Soviet musicologist Solertinsky.
And there was actually something unique about this recording of this trio.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. This is a recording of Shostakovich himself at the piano, along with David Oistrakh on the violin and Miloš Sadlo on the cello. It's a historic recording, and what a treasure it is for us to have recordings where the composers play themselves.
Thank you.
We heard three selections of music that are based off of short little harmonic progressions. Those are called either Passacaglia or Chaconne, depending on which musicologist you're speaking to at the moment. We ended the set with music of Shostakovich from his Piano Trio No. 2. Before that was an excerpt from the last movement of Johannes Brahms' Symphony No. 4. And we began the set with the very mournful Chaconne from the violin partita in D minor by J.S. Bach. We were talking a little bit, Dr. Cooper, about how the most sure form of flattery is just imitation. And for a composer especially, I'd have to say that plagiarism is the most sure form of flattery, a way of saying, I really love this little section of music, or it just really speaks to me. I think you have a couple of examples of that for us.
I do, and I've chosen two examples to end our program this morning from the 20th century, works that incorporate actual music from J.S. Bach. The first is the Albanberg Violin Concerto. The second section of this concerto is built on a chorale melody from the Bach cantata O Ewigkeit, du Donnerwort. The chorale title is Es ist genug, or It is Enough. And I'd like us to listen first to a recording of this chorale from Cantata 60. One of the things that strikes me about that chorale is the incredible harmonization. We're hearing some wild harmonies there. I'm not sure, and frankly, musicologists aren't really sure why Berg included this chorale in the violin concerto. But as I mentioned a moment ago, the slow movement that's in the second section of the violin concerto is based on this melody from this chorale. And Berg does a remarkable thing. We're going to hear an excerpt where you'll hear Berg present the first four notes of the chorale in the violin. And then in our excerpt, there's a dialogue back and forth between the winds in the orchestra who play the Bach chorale as it stands in Bach, with commentary by strings and the solo violin of Berg's own music. It's as though Berg is presenting a juxtaposition of his own highly dissonant style with this Bach chorale, which in itself has some pretty wild harmonic moments. Our last example this morning is a piece by the 20th century American composer George Crumb. To the best of my knowledge, he is still living. And it's from his set of chamber pieces, Ancient Voices of Children, specifically the section Todas las Tardes en Granada, or Every Afternoon in Granada, and then it continues the text, A Child Dies. What you'll hear in this is a very poignant and expressive use by Crumb towards the end of the excerpt of that great Bach piece, Bist du bei mir, Be by me, be near me, and it's played on a toy piano. What a poignant connection to the text of Every Afternoon a Child Dies in Granada. The George Crumb Ancient Voices of Children.
We heard Todas las Tardes en Granada by George Crumb from the Ancient Voices of Children, complete with a quote played on toy piano of Bist du bei mir by Bach. That is a somewhat sad but yet quite fitting way to close our Epic Bach Week. We've been focusing on many different aspects of the music of J.S. Bach this week, and today we've been focusing on Bach the Inspiration. Dr. Peter Cooper from Southern Adventist University has been my guest today. Thank you so much, Dr. Cooper, for joining us.
Robbie, you're welcome. It's been a real privilege to be part of Epic Bach Week. Thank you for the invitation.
And thank you for joining us this morning and all this week for the Epic Bach Week right here on the 3Bs. I'm Robbie Rainey, and I've been your host. I'm looking for your comments. Did you enjoy the shows this week? Give me a call. Our number is 866-905-WSMC, or you can send me an email via our website, wsmc.org. I'd like to thank my producers for this week of programs. They're Brendan Dodd, Joshua Farnsworth, and Stephen Clark. I owe Emily Karlinski a lot for allowing me to do these programs and for helping me to edit them and make them enjoyable and informative for you. And I'd also like to thank Judy Glass for introducing me to the life that's in Bach's music. And most importantly, I'd like to end this set of programs with the way that Bach signed many of his manuscripts. Soli Deo Gloria. Until Monday, I hope you have a wonderful day and a wonderful weekend.